This was one of those weeks where we found out exactly what Janet Yellen was thinking. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Also, why slower might be better on Wall Street. And we're going to wrap up our series, The Price of Profits. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday. This one is, I believe, the 17th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We're going to dig right in. Lots to talk about. Not a whole lot of time. Cardiff Garcia is here. He was with the blog FT Alphaville. Technically, he's in New York. Neela Richardson is here as well. She is at Redfin, technically in Washington. The topic, of course, is the 5 days gone by. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kat.
Neela, you get to go first. Janet Yellen, Fed met this week, did nothing on interest rates. Dr. Yellen had a press conference. What was the most surprising thing that came out of that whole smash for you?
I think the most surprising thing is how big a window is left open in terms of what the Fed will consider when they're considering whether or not to hike rates. And that big window was Brexit. We are now looking at local international politics to guide domestic monetary decisions. And that's a big deal because anything can fit there in any country in a very globally and economically unstable world right now, especially in Europe. So this is a key question about how European politics will fit into Fed monetary policy going forward.
All right. So, Cardiff, we're going to get to Brexit and uncertainty in a second. I want to ask you, though, about this. I read, might have been on FT Alphaville, but certainly out there in the interwebs, that Janet Yellen might be a closet one hiker. That is to say, even though the official Fed line is we're going to raise twice this year, that she secretly is in favor of doing it just once.
That's a possibility. I think one significant thing did happen at the meeting, which is that she used the phrase new normal. Right.
Ooh.
And what she meant, meant was that it's possible that the relationship between how the Fed manages interest rates and the real economy might have changed. So in the past, if the economy's picking up, in order to slow inflation, they'd start hiking interest rates.
Right.
And what she meant was that now that relationship might be different, that the shallower path at which she's going to hike interest rates is now more appropriate than it would have been in the past. And so I thought that was actually kind of startling. I didn't anticipate it. But yeah, I think it's important. I don't know if it means that they're going to hike just once this year or that they're going to hike again. It depends on the real economy. And as they love to say, they are data dependent. And I actually believe that now more than I have in quite some time.
Neela, were you surprised? And I don't want to spend too long on the Fed, so be brief about this. But were you surprised at how derailed the Fed got by one lousy jobs report when arguably everything else is doing okay?
No. And I think I wasn't surprised because I think they were a little bit too optimistic before that jobs report came in. And just to add a little bit to Cardiff's point, these long-term factors that could be depressing economic growth are now a growing concern at the Fed. We used to talk about this being short-term, one great quarter of data, we can lower rates. Now they're saying maybe these things are actually going to have a big influence over a long period of time and not go away really quickly. That's a big difference.
Yeah. All right, Cardiff, to the Brexit thing, setting aside the events of this week with Joe Cox, the MP who was killed, what's your gut on how this thing's going to go?
Oh, man. I mean, the polls really have turned in favor of leaving. It's been quite shocking to see how quickly that happened.
Yeah.
So I don't know which way it's going to go. This is a really hard thing to poll in advance. It could be that many more people turn out to vote than we've anticipated. But yeah, it's not looking good right now. That's for sure.
Neela, on this thing, just to get back to your opening answer about Brexit and uncertainty, we've been doing a whole riff here the past couple of weeks about this idea of uncertainty and how big a deal it is. Does it feel different to you this time around, what with our presidential election and everything that's going on there, and the possibility that there are some fundamental cracks in the European Union?
You know, I see some commonalities here. These were both, a year ago, very low probability events.
Right.
And then the closer we get to the election, they become more and more reality. And I think the impact is greater because nobody saw them coming.
Cardiff,
that's the case with Brexit, for sure.
Yeah.
Cardiff, your thoughts?
Yeah, there are some commonalities here, and I've noticed this because a lot of my British colleagues talk about it. Essentially, Brexit has become a referendum partly on the economy and more so on immigration policy, which is itself an economic issue. And so I think you've seen the rise of populist sentiment both in the U.S. and the U.K. and throughout the developed world, and this is one of its clear manifestations. Yeah, there are some commonalities there for sure.
Huh. Cardiff Garcia at the blog FT Alphaville, Neela Richardson at Redfin. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend, everybody. Wall Street today? Yeah, no. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Some news now about the importance of speed in capitalism, in market-based capitalism, to be more precise. The Securities and Exchange Commission has before it an application for a new stock exchange to be called IEX. The thing is, IEX isn't just any stock exchange. It is a just slightly slower than your average stock exchange. The idea in this era where speed is everything is to put everybody on an even playing field so faster traders can't outfox the slower ones. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports by way of explanation, saying you want to slow things down on Wall Street, well, them's fighting words.
So IEX is a stock exchange, like the NASDAQ or the NYSE, but there's one little difference.
The IEX places a very small delay in how it processes orders.
Larry Harris is a professor of finance at the USC Marshall School of Business. Now, let's just be real here, okay? The quote-unquote delay is 0.00035 seconds.
And the purpose of this delay is to frustrate high-frequency traders.
High-frequency traders are a type of super-fast trader with better computers, faster connections. So let's say your pension fund is trying to buy a ton of stock. The high-frequency trader races in at light speed and gets that same stock before the pension fund is even done buying it, helping drive up the price. The pension fund could end up paying more. The super-fast trader made a quick buck.
And, of course, that's not good for the market because we don't like to see orders having a lot of price impact.
So having even a teensy delay basically makes that kind of light speed maneuvering impossible. And that's the value add for IEX. What could be the problem with that?
The issue is if you're forced to use it. And that's what I think is the controversy.
John Jacobs directs the Center for Financial Markets and Policy at Georgetown.
What happens if the price is there, you're forced to route to them, they have that speed bump in, and the price moves on some other venue before you get there.
What he's saying is, sure, great, IEX has a delay. But there are a lot of other stock markets out there also trading shares without delays. What if investors miss out on a good price while they're waiting on that speed bump?
Well, it's certainly a possibility.
Again, Larry Harris at the Marshall School.
We have to ask ourselves, how often do we think this is going to happen?
Harris says maybe not that often, and maybe the risk is worth it for a more level playing field. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
If you read Michael Lewis's latest book, by the way, Flash Boys, it's called, you'll remember that IEX is the startup exchange at the center of that story. If you didn't read it, well, you can find my interview with Michael about the book at marketplace.org. Mosques around the country are going to be crowded again tonight as Muslims observe Ramadan. Security in many or possibly most places could be high. Threats and acts of vandalism directed at mosques and Islamic centers around the country have been on the rise in the wake of Paris and San Bernardino and Orlando and the presidential campaign, it should be said. And mosques have been forced to take extra precautions. Protection that Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports comes at a price.
Outside the Islamic Center of Southern California, an armed security guard stands tall, arms folded back. Inside, there are surveillance cameras, a lot of them.
Up in the corner over here, you can see one hanging from over there that we've got. We got cameras in the lecture hall as well.
Omar Ricci is the spokesperson for the Islamic Center.
Now that we're looking at it more consciously, it feels a little bit Orwellian.
32 cameras. That's on top of 5 security guards brought on after the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino. All that protection runs more than $70,000 a year, Ricci says.
For us and for other mosques around the nation, it's just a cost of doing business right now.
Osama Shami gets that. He heads up the Islamic Community Center of Phoenix. It was vandalized 8 times last year, including after Donald Trump called for a ban on Muslims entering the country.
Somebody broke expensive windows to the office. We had people shooting bullets at the mosque.
Shammy says repairs cost the center about $4,000. It also invested $20,000 on security cameras, money that could have gone towards Syrian refugees or finishing construction on a woman's bathroom. Another problem?
People are scared to come to the mosque, so donations go down.
So does enrollment in Sunday school, which has dropped by 50%. Zainab Chaudhry is with the Council on American Islamic Relations. She says government money is available for security. Mosques can get up to $75,000 through a FEMA grant.
Unfortunately, because there is a lot of red tape and bureaucracy, it presents an obstacle for mosque leaders oftentimes.
Even worse, Chaudhry says, many don't even know the grants exist. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Coming up.
A good job pays well and treats their workers right.
Harder to find than they used to be, though. First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 57 points today, about 0.3%, 17,675 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ dropped 44 points, 0.9%, 4,800 even. The S&P 500 gave up 6 points, 0.3%, 2,071. For the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow slid 1%. The NASDAQ off 1.9%, the S&P 500 down 1.2%. Apple had a downer day after the Beijing Intellectual Property Bureau, you say that 10 times fast, Beijing Intellectual Property Bureau said the iPhone 6 violates a Chinese patent. Apple is, of course, appealing, shares off 2.2% nonetheless. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.60%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The through line of the program this week has been our series, The Price of Profits, in which we have taken the Wall Street mantra of gotta increase shareholder value, gotta maximize shareholder profit. We have taken that and looked at it every which way. The corporate angle, the CEO angle, the culture of Wall Street angle, the historical angle. Today, the jobs angle, because if companies are going to increase shareholder value, labor costs are a biggie that they've got to take care of. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has more on the price of profits and the changing nature of work.
If you're a tourist in Nashville, it's easy to think this city is built entirely on music. It pours out of the honky-tonks and cafes here 7 nights a week. But step outside the city's entertainment district and you bump into Nissan, HCA, Bridgestone, Amazon. Tax incentives and right-to-work laws helped get them here. And now Metro Nashville ranks fourth on Forbes' Best Big Cities for Jobs. But a growing number of workers here aren't company men and women. They freelance, work on contract, on demand, for temp and staffing agencies. 41-year-old Amy Walters is among the freelancers. And yeah, she works from home.
Hey, Bertha, come on. Bertha!
Walters works for an online startup called Gun.io, as in hired gun. The company matches freelance software developers with business clients who want to outsource digital projects, mobile apps and the like. Walters walks into a small converted bedroom.
This is where all the work happens. I need a laptop, I need a phone, I need an internet connection.
And that's it.
Pretty much, in various apps that, you know, allow me to collaborate with developers across the world.
Tech freelancers are a familiar breed. Walters and others finding work through Gun are paid well, typically $100 an hour. But it's part-time, no benefits, and career development, that's on them. As long as they can keep up their skills, the thinking goes, they'll have work. Though Walters says getting laid off once from a full-time job, on 9/11 of all days, makes her think twice about that.
Yeah, that was, it shook me, you know, so I think about financial future now or going forward, and I feel like
I mean, how stable are any of us, really?
Actually, job stability went out the window decades ago. Just ask any American who's been escorted out by security in a mass layoff or whose factory moved offshore. In a global marketplace constantly upended by technology, companies are under unrelenting pressure to cut costs and maximize profits. If companies can do business without permanent employees, they will. Technology and contractors make that easier every day. And Wall Street approves. Jerry Davis is author of The Vanishing American Corporation.
At minimum, Wall Street does not value having employees. At maximum, you might be punished.
New research by economists Lawrence Katz and Alan Krueger suggests that all the net job growth in the last decade has been temporary, contract, and gig work. That includes Uber-type jobs, but much more is work contracted out to staffing agencies. 33-year-old Stephen Ferguson had one of those jobs. He helped build SUVs at the Nissan assembly plant near Nashville. But he wasn't hired by Nissan. He worked for a labor contractor called Yates Services. That meant working alongside regular Nissan employees doing the same job, but for roughly half the pay and little job security.
There would be people that would be scared to go to medical inside that plant, that they would get sent home and then would never be allowed to come back there again.
Ferguson did eventually get hired through a Nissan transition program called Pathways, but others can stay contract workers for years. Nissan's not alone here. All automakers now rely on temps to some degree. So do many manufacturers, warehouses, and call centers. Army veteran Brian Gammy is an ex-Nissan contractor as well. He says when he returned home from Iraq in 2010, he was shocked that all he could get was fill-in and contract jobs. At one point, he was working for three different temp firms.
It seems to be an ever-growing trend in the job force anymore that everything is temp. And it is really hard to actually get on with an actual company anymore.
And that, he says, can put a grown-up life on hold.
Even if you want to get a home loan, or the bank looks at it and they say, oh, well, you work for Yates Services. You're a temporary employee. When are you going to get a real job?
Corporations have quietly been shedding real jobs for years, not just through offshoring and automation. American business now farms out a surprising amount of work that used to be done in-house, from HR to IT, from marketing to maintenance. I even met an emergency room doctor in Nashville who worked for a physician outsourcing firm. It's standard practice now in many hospital ERs. Stanford University business professor Jeffrey Pfeffer.
Employees, you know, impose overhead costs and burdens, and you have to, you know, fire them using some reasonable due process, and you have to pay benefits and Social Security and all this other stuff. And so it's much cheaper to just get rid of them.
You can make a strong business case for outsourcing. As market demands change, you can easily and more cheaply staff up or down. You can access a staffing firm's vast database of talent rather than investing in your own. All this corporate efficiency lowers prices for consumers. It's raised profits for stockholders, but at the expense of workers. David Weil, head of the Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division, argues the outsourced economy exacerbates wage inequality.
We have a lot of good economic studies that show this actually happens, that the wages of a janitor who works as a contractor are significantly below those of the same janitor doing the same kind of job if he's directly my employee.
At worst, subcontractors violate labor laws to stay competitive. 28-year-old Deanna Lopez was a housekeeper in a 4-star hotel in Nashville, but she worked for a subcontractor, not the name on the marquee or even the company managing the hotel.
You work under a lot of stress here because, like, sometimes they give you 20 or 25 minutes per room, but they want it to be perfect.
Lopez earned $8.75 an hour with no benefits. At one point, she says she and her coworkers noticed hours and entire days missing from their paychecks. Chuck Yesbeck is an employee rights attorney in Nashville.
I've seen a lot of maids that work in hotels that don't even make minimum wage. How can it happen? It happens because the employer will pay them a rate per room, and the rate per room isn't enough for them to earn minimum wage, and often they won't pay overtime.
Lopez and her coworkers did recover their wages with the help of a workers' rights group, and the Labor Department is trying to make companies more responsible for contracted workers. But good jobs, the kind political candidates vow to bring back, business doesn't need those like it used to. Companies can now capture huge market share without committing to huge numbers of workers. Here in Nashville, gigs used to be for working musicians. Today, the audience knows what that's like, too. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
It'll get better if you drink. I don't know if you're aware of that, right?
It's not like it's a new thing, the way the job market in this country has been changing. But you throw the way technology has developed and the speed it has developed at, and it's a whole new ballgame. A ballgame for which the labor market and the support system that we've got right now isn't really equipped. Virginia Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat, has been vocal about the need for a new way to think about our on-demand economy. So we called him up and we asked him where he thinks things are going to go.
I think we're going to need to create a different set of worker classifications. I think we're going to need to create portable benefits that will travel with an individual, and so that a small part of your income, no matter what kind of legal classification, a small part would be set aside for health, retirement, disability. We have opportunities to create this, frankly, using some of the same technologies that gets that Uber to arrive in front of you. If we think forward-leaning and don't get caught back in this 20th century binary choice between W-2 and 1099.
But if I'm Travis Kanalek, just the CEO of Uber, just because you mentioned that company, or in fact, if I'm a young Mark Warner, right, because you came out of private industry before you went into politics, what is the business owners, the small business persons or big business persons response to demands that he or she do something about this? Whose responsibility is it, I guess, is the question.
Now, in the 21st century, who runs these benefit packages? I think we have to experiment. And that's going to require Congress to get out of a 20th century mindset. It's going to require, and they're starting to see some of this, more experimentation at state and local levels to try out some of these new models. The alternative is that we end up with an economy where 35% of Americans who are in this contingent workforce in one form or another have no social insurance. If that suddenly goes to 60, 70, 80%, and that's where we're headed, then when bad things happen to folks, there's nothing to catch them on the way down. And that's not a country that is going to remain the leader in the world.
It's a little bit like those criticisms that the Pentagon always gets about fighting the last war, right, Senator? I mean, here we are in an election campaign where the middle class and its welfare is arguably, at some points in the campaign, has been front and center. Not hearing a whole lot about the gig economy, though.
The challenge is both we're not hearing about the gig economy. We're not hearing about how we rethink a social contract that worked for 70 years in the 20th century but isn't fully working in the 21st century. And I think both political leaders need to weigh in on this. I think responsible business leaders need to weigh in as well. Just think about the terminology we use. If I invest in a piece of equipment, that's an asset. If I invest in training of someone who works with me, that's a cost. We need to rethink that whole framework. And now we're not going to slow down technology, but it's time for capitalism 2.0. If we're going to make sure that we keep an America where everybody feels they've got the fair shot that I was lucky enough to have, and I think most of your listeners have probably had.
Mark Warner, once a small business person, now a Democratic senator from the state of Virginia. Senator, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
We packed a whole lot into the price of profits this week because there is a whole lot going on. Economic uncertainty here and abroad, globalization, how companies make their profits and what they do with that money. We'll leave you with this. Sort of a coda to Sarah Gardner's piece about the thing that helps the whole economy go round in the first place. What is a good job to you?
I think a good job is one that challenges you and that you feel like you're contributing to society.
A good job? Something stable, obviously.
Something I love waking up to do every morning. I don't have to feel like I have to do it.
Good benefits, of course. Good pay. Someplace that you're appreciated for your talents, someplace that allows you room to have growth.
A good job, pays well, and treats their workers right.
A position where I can use my creativity.
I think it's one where it's a culture where you're allowed to blossom and grow and thrive.
That was Rebecca Vendemo, Sonia Schutte, Andres Rivera, Joy Smith, Jason Phillips, Carly Kristen Shambly, John Thomas, and Lakita Stribling. Let me give you the website one last time. The whole series is going to live there in case you want to go back to it. Priceofprofits.org. This final note on the way out today, in which your drives to and fro could get just a hair longer. If you use Waze, the crowdsourced navigation app, which I do, full disclosure, you know it has a fatal flaw, right? The often hairy, sometimes downright dangerous left turns it orders you to do. All right, doesn't order, but suggests, you know what I mean. As of today, to be rolled out first here in Los Angeles, Waze will offer drivers an alternative route, like maybe going to the closest signal instead of playing real-life Frogger or using a bunch of right turns to get where you're going. Me, I honestly, and this is true, I just want them to bring back the Morgan Freeman voice option. Friday, quitting time. Dow off 57 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 44 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 gave up 6 points, 0.3%. Worse all the way around for the week, by the way. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back again on Monday, as we always are. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.